Sedu.
Yes, Daddy Sam.
Have you heard what has unfolded over our line?
No. Nothing, brother. What is the problem?
I am told there's an investor who wants to take over our land. And we have been asked to vacate as soon as possible.
Hey, Daddy Sam. Who tells you? I inherited this land from my grandmother, Zabeti, 30 years ago. I can't vacate from it. Never. I can't relocate anywhere else, I swear upon the living God. Come on, colleagues. You don't have to hustle and worry. We have a solution to all land issues around us. We have Witness Radio. They are here to sensitize and advocate for land rights and environmental protection. Listen to Witness Radio as it unveils all issues regarding to land use and the law regulations of land use. Witness Radio also has legal officers to advise and advocate for your rights, especially those who have been evicted from their land, and they also mediate into land wrangles.
Wow! That is good news!
Do you have any information in regards to land grabbing? Or are you aware of any person who has been evicted and their property destroyed because of land disputes? Report to Witness Radio through our numbers 0414-697-221 or WhatsApp 0745-965-765. Or you can report directly to our website on www.witnessradio.org. Just click on the map, follow the direction, click on the map indicating the individuals and the land being grabbed. Click on that word, report evictions. Then report any victim of land evictions. Thereafter, search for your area of residence on that map. Click your area of residence, then a red dot will indicate. Click the red dot and fill in the form, then save your input. Don't forget to attach the picture of the grabbed land in question, then upload to send.
Welcome to Witness Radio Broadcast Program.
Hello, welcome to everyone who is joining. We are going to start in just a few minutes. We had over 300 people register for today's conversation, so we're going to wait a moment or two as the additional participants join. Thank you.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining. I think we can go ahead and get started, recognizing other people will join in the next few minutes. So thank you for making the time to join today's webinar. I want to start by sharing about interpretation. So this webinar will be conducted in English, and we have interpretation in Portuguese and in Spanish. So to activate the interpretation, click on the globe icon or interpretation. Usually it's at the bottom of your screen, and then just choose your preferred language, Portuguese or Spanish. And I'm going to share those instructions in Portuguese and Spanish so that everyone has access to that information. So, olá, bem-vindos e bem-vindas e todas e todas. Vamos começar em alguns minutos. Este webinar será em inglês e temos interpretação em português. Para ativar, clique no ícone do globo ou interpretação na parte inferior da tela. Escolha o idioma que prefere, português ou espanhol. Olá, bienvenidos y bienvenidas. Vamos a empezar en unos minutos. Este webinar será en inglés y tenemos interpretación. Para activar, haz clic en el icono del globo o interpretación en la parte inferior de la pantalla. Seleccione el idioma que desea, español o portugués. So I hope everyone has been able to access the interpretation, but we will also put in the chat the instructions as we recognize people will continue to join.
Breaking the silence and elevating community voices. Witness Radio, your number one choice.
So once again, thank you for joining today's conversation. My name is Kristen Dobson. I'm the co-head of the Civic Freedoms and Human Rights Defenders Program with my colleague Anna Zhbona at the Business and Human Rights Resource Center. I want to mention that we are live streaming this on YouTube. It's being recorded and it's also being shared via community radio station in Uganda by one of our partners, Witness Radio. We want to start by getting a sense of who is on the call. We had so many people register, which is wonderful, that we can't go around and do introductions, but we wanted to have a poll to get a sense of who's here. So if I could ask one of my colleagues to pull up. So this first question is just asking what region you're joining from. So if you can indicate Africa, Asia and the Pacific, Eastern Europe and Russia, Latin America and the Caribbean, Middle East and North Africa, North America, for this Canada and the US, and Western and Central Europe, and also prefer not to say if you would like to not share that information. And we'll give it another minute or two, and you'll see there's a second question. What stakeholder group are you affiliated with? This is, you know, which you most identify with, and you can choose more than one. So as a human rights defender yourself, local or national civil society organization, regional civil society organization, international company, investor, government, UN, or other, or prefer not to say. Can still see a few responses coming in, but I think we can go ahead and end the poll. Okay, so we can see that there's a wide geographic distribution of those who are joining, which is wonderful, and also among stakeholder groups. We can see we have human rights defenders on the call, civil society at the local, regional, and international level, a number of companies, and also some investors. So thank you very much for joining this conversation. And today we are launching a new report at the Resource Center that highlights the vital work of human rights defenders, raising concerns about business-related human rights risks and harms across the globe, including many of the wins that human rights defenders have had over the past 10 years to stop corporate abuse and shape better business practice. This report builds on nearly 10 years of work at the Resource Center, but also in collaboration with so many of you, to highlight the wins of defenders challenging corporate harm, to document attacks on defenders, monitor the role of business in attacks and restrictions on civic freedoms, addressing the root causes of violence against defenders, and also exploring positive actions that companies and investors can take to support civic freedoms and defenders. For those on the call who are less familiar with the term human rights defenders, it is a term who describes people individually or with others that act to promote and protect human rights in a peaceful manner. This can be individuals, communities, organizations, and this can include any of us who act or promote and protect human rights. We all have the right to defend human rights. At the Resource Center, our work specifically focuses on human rights defenders speaking out or taking action related to business-related risks and harms. This includes Indigenous peoples protecting forests from illegal logging, to journalists exposing health and environmental harms related to mining, to workers advocating for better conditions in the garment sector. Human rights defenders are at the forefront of creating a more equitable, sustainable, and abundant world for all of us, where our rights are protected, people and nature thrive, and just economies can flourish. Yet those who do this work often face great risk and violence, and that is one thing we'll explore in today's conversation. I am joined by three amazing speakers: Iko Dangla, an environmental human rights defender from Pangasinan province in the Philippines; Natalie Segovia, executive director and senior attorney with Water Protector Legal Collective; and Mary Beth Gallagher, director of engagement with Domini Impact Investments. Thank you all for being here and for sharing with us. I want to talk a little bit about the flow of our time together. So I will proceed with sharing some of the key findings of our report, which is available in English, Spanish, Portuguese, and French. And we have key findings available in Japanese and Russian as well. Then we'll hear from each speaker, and then we'll have some time for Q&A. So for all of you to put any questions you may have for any of the speakers in the chat. And so with that, I'll move into our presentation and ask my colleague to share a few slides. And also, as people have started doing, please feel free to introduce yourselves in the chat if it's something you're comfortable sharing and also where you're joining from.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
So yesterday we launched our report, Defending Rights in Realizing Just Economies, Human Rights Defenders in Business, spanning 2015 to 2024. Next slide, please. During this time period, we tracked more than 6,400 reported attacks across 147 countries. This is close to two attacks on average every day over the past 10 years against human rights defenders, people who are raising concerns about business-related harm. 75% of these attacks were against climate, land, and environmental defenders, people who are protecting our planet and trying to fight climate change. In 2024 alone, we tracked 660 attacks. Human rights defenders are doing this work in a very challenging context. According to one of our partners, Civicus, only 3.6% of the world's population lives in countries with open civic space, where citizens and civil society organizations are able to organize, participate, and communicate without restrictions. Also, attacks on defenders and restrictions on civic freedoms are bad for business. They prevent companies and investors from accessing crucial information about human rights impacts and risks that they need. And this increases operational, financial, and reputational risk for companies. Next slide, please. So before we talk about where attacks are taking place, I also just want to highlight that what we've tracked is the tip of the iceberg. So we track attacks based on publicly available information, and many of the attacks that happen against human rights defenders are never shared publicly. And there's a number of reasons for that. One, just civic restrictions on the freedom of the press and on civil society make it quite difficult. It's also dangerous to document attacks. They may not be shared for security reasons. People who face higher levels of marginalization due to racism and other forms of oppression may face greater risks with reporting attacks. And governments aren't tracking attacks. The work we've done with Allied, a coalition supporting land, environmental, and indigenous defenders, have looked at governments' voluntary reporting as their progress on the SDGs. And they found that of the 188 reports that have been submitted since 2015, progress on the SDGs, only four indicated that at least one HRD, journalist, or trade unionist have been killed. You'll see that's in stark contrast to our research and research by many of our peers, such as Global Witness, Frontline Defenders, and many others. So when we look at the most dangerous regions in the world for defenders based on publicly available information, we can see that the highest level of attacks were in Latin America and the Caribbean and Asia and the Pacific, accounting for close to three and four attacks in the past decade. Next slide, please. And this shows the countries with the highest number of attacks. So Brazil had the highest number of attacks on defenders raising concerns about corporate harm. Then Mexico, Honduras, the Philippines, India, Colombia, Peru, Cambodia, the United States, Guatemala, Indonesia, and Russia. Next slide. In terms of the type of attacks that we see very high levels of judicial harassment. So this includes arbitrary detention, slaps, criminalization, and we tracked over 530 instances of strategic lawsuits against public participation, otherwise known as slaps. We also see a very high number of killings of defenders, followed by intimidation and threats. And also just want to flag that many threats in some contexts are so commonplace that these are never reported. So we know this number is much higher, as well as other forms of non-lethal physical violence. We also see a crackdown on the right to protest across the globe. Next slide. Our research reveals a disproportionately high level of attacks against Indigenous defenders who are on the forefront of addressing the climate crisis and protecting our planet. Indigenous peoples manage over 20% of the Earth's land surface, and they bring thousands of years of expertise in environmental stewardship. Despite comprising 6% of the world's population, 1 in 5 attacks were against Indigenous peoples. We also see that the rate of murder for Indigenous defenders is higher than for non-Indigenous defenders. 1 in 4 attacks on Indigenous defenders ended in murder. Women, girls, and gender diverse defenders also experience different types of attacks and face risks in different spheres as they're challenging corporate power and patriarchal gender norms as well in their society, organizations, and in their communities. The types of attacks they face may be differentiated and gendered in nature. That might include, for example, smear campaigns against women and gender diverse defenders online using sexualized or other gendered language. And the risks are even higher for women, girls, and gender diverse defenders who hold multiple marginalized identities, such as Indigenous defenders or Afro-descendant defenders. So one of the angles we look at specifically at the Resource Center is the business sectors connected with attacks. So when we say connected with attacks, what we're referring to is either the defender was raising concerns about companies or that sector broadly, or a company in that sector was involved with the attack in some way. So mining has been consistently the most dangerous sector for defenders, showing little progress in the past 10 years to prevent attacks, followed by agribusiness and fossil fuels. We're also unfortunately seeing that a number of renewable energy projects have been connected to attacks, primarily hydropower. Next.
Breaking the silence and elevating community voices. Witness Radio, your number one choice.
It's very difficult to access information about perpetrators of attacks due to lack of information, due to the crackdown on freedom of the press worldwide, and it's often investigative journalists that are uncovering this information. But in the public information we had available, we could see that state actors were the most common perpetrators of attacks, police officers, local authorities, and the judiciary, often prioritizing economic profits over human rights and protection of the environment. And a common pattern that we see is a business project proceeds without consultation or insufficient consultation with affected stakeholders or without the free, prior, and informed consent of Indigenous peoples. People then raise concerns, exercising their right to protest, freedom of speech, about the social and environmental risks, and then police, military, or private security guards attack or arrest protesters. And the highest number of reported attacks in relation to business projects by companies were headquartered in the US, the United Kingdom, and Canada. And the UN guiding principles on business and human rights are very clear. If a business actor is causing or contributing to human rights abuse affecting defenders, they have to end the abuse, address it, and remedy any harm that occurred. Next. We also looked at the projects with the highest number of recorded attacks over the past 10 years. The project where there was the highest number of attacks recorded in publicly available information was the Lake Albert oil development project. So this is the East Africa Crude Oil Pipeline, Tilenga, and Kingfisher. And you can see here in the slide the companies that are involved with these projects. We've also invited these companies to respond, and you'll see their responses for many of them in the report. Followed by Inversiones Los Pinares in Honduras, which is iron mining, the Dakota Access Pipeline in the United States. Next slide. Las Bambas mine, copper mining in Peru, and Line 3 pipeline in the United States. Next. So I want to wrap up just with a couple of recommendations. The report includes a list of recommendations for governments, for companies, and for investors. For governments, I'm not going to read through all of these, but I really want to emphasize that governments should pass legislation recognizing the right to defend rights and committing to zero tolerance for attacks. And this includes legal recognition of the specific rights of Indigenous and Afro-descendant peoples, and also to pass mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence legislation. Next. In our recommendations for companies, the first is adopting and implementing a company-wide policy, committing to not tolerate or be involved with attacks. And this is something we've seen progress on over the past decade. With this research starting in 2015, at that point, there were no companies we were aware of that had these policies. Adidas was the first company in 2016, and now we've seen 51 policy commitments to not tolerate or contribute to attacks on defenders. Next slide. Finally, we have recommendations for investors, and you'll hear more from Mary Beth Gallagher, an investor, later on this call. So thank you very much for listening to this presentation. And I want to transition into asking our speakers several questions and really having a chance to hear from their experiences. So we're going to hear first from Iko. Iko, you've been engaged in numerous human rights and environmental campaigns raising concerns about business-related harms, including against a black sand mining project and coal-fired power plants. Can you share more about your activism and the risks you have faced related to your activism?
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Good day, Kristen. Good day, everyone. I'm Eko Dangla, an environmentalist in the province of Pangasinan in the Philippines. And I started as a youth environmentalist during my university days. And we campaigned against a large dam, particularly the San Roque Dam, San Roque Multipurpose Dam Project. And during the height of the campaign in the early 2000s, I have two colleagues killed by state security forces, namely a peasant leader named Jose Doton and a human rights advocate named Mariano Sepnio. And those days are one of the darkest during the past decades and in terms of human rights and democracy here in the Philippines. And I drew inspiration from them. So I continued fighting for the environment and human rights in my country. So I got involved in numerous campaigns, such as opposition to the revival of the Bataan nuclear power plant and other large dams, particularly here in our region, in Central Luzon, Philippines. And a few years ago, along with other people's organization in my province of Pangasinan, we founded Pangasinan People's Strike for the Environment. And among the first campaigns we launched is the opposition to the second coal power plant in our province. And this power plant will be funded by Korea Electric Power Corporation. And the campaign was successful, and the coal power plant was rescinded. And after that, the network became a campaign center against environmental destructive projects, such as proposed waste-to-energy incinerators, and then the proposed black sand or magnetite mining. And quite recently, before our abduction last year, against the proposed six nuclear power plants in one of the towns in my province. And during these campaigns, I have been together with our different organizations. We have been vilified as anti-development, and the vilification intensified during the previous president. And it's during these times that I have been tagged by the Regional Peace and Order Council in my region, in Region 1, as a regional threat. And also, I was also tagged as a recruiter for the communists. And before I was abducted on March 24 last year, together with a colleague, another colleague working among peasant and fisherfolk communities was abducted. Her name was Maria Elena Pamposa, and she's the first victim of enforced disappearance under the current Marcos Jr. administration. And since July 4, 2022, it's been 3 years now, and they are still missing up to now. And currently, there are around 36 victims of abduction or enforced disappearances of environmental defenders here in the Philippines. And at least 16 of them are missing up until now. And my experience as a environmental defender, When we were abducted last year, we were forced inside the vehicle, we were tied and blindfolded, we were tortured physically and psychologically, and we were forced to admit that we are members of the Communist Party of the Philippines and the New People's Army. But I think what was the turning point was because of the uproar among environmental organizations and human rights and faith-based organizations in the Philippines and abroad. We were released by our abductors after 3 days. So we were released on March 27th, 2024. I think that's it, Kristen.
Thank you, Iko, for first sharing about your experience, for highlighting the horrific level of violence that environmental and human rights defenders are facing in the Philippines, and also for sharing about your successful campaigning. Thank you for being here. Natalie, we'll turn to you now. The Water Protector Legal Collective has served as the on-the-ground legal team for Indigenous-led resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. Both the Dakota Access Pipeline and Line 3 have faced strong opposition by Indigenous peoples, and were among the five projects with the highest number of recorded attacks on defenders globally in this research. Can you share more about the nature and scale of attacks on defenders raising environmental and human rights concerns about these pipelines, as well as the experience of Indigenous defenders challenging corporate harm globally?
Do you want to tune in to Witness Radio? Go to Play Store on your phone, type Witness Radio. You will see the application, download it, and start listening to Witness Radio. You can also visit our website on www.witnessradio.org. Click Live on your PC's right hand, then click the button in the middle. Then listen to Witness Radio and learn all issues about land and environmental protection.
Sumakpunchai, anchatan anchaiki, kaipikas kaikimanta. Good morning and good evening. Thank you so much for joining us here. Thank you, Kristen, for this important question. Water Protector Legal Collective started at Standing Rock really in defense of treaty rights, in defense of the water, and water protectors facing criminalization in over 800 cases that were brought by the state of North Dakota. So our work as an organization has continued on other front lines, including Line 3, where we saw over 900 arrests of water protectors. In the past 20 years, as a human rights lawyer and as a human rights advocate, even before I was a lawyer, I have seen firsthand the desecration of Indigenous lands and waters. I've seen sacred sites destroyed, forced displacement of Indigenous communities, and stolen rivers in rural and remote areas of the world due to extractive industry, which often happens under a cloak of invisibility and impunity. My work in the US and internationally really focuses on making this visible. So to your question, why, right? Consistently, Indigenous peoples are on the front lines of climate disruption, of human rights attacks, not by choice, but by necessity. When you have 6% of the world population that constitutes the Indigenous peoples of the world, stewarding 25% of the land, containing 80% of the world's remaining biodiversity, we are immediately pitted against development and infrastructure as part of an existential threat. So what we're seeing is that globally, our lands, Indigenous lands, are resource rich, and it leads to a routine violation of legal rights. So globally, we have 54% of critical minerals like lithium, copper, cobalt, nickel, found on or near Indigenous territories. What this means in the U.S. alone, for instance, 75% of those transition minerals are located within 35 miles of an Indian reservation. In Canada, similarly, 70% of mines are within 200 kilometers of Indigenous communities. And in the Amazon, 50% of oil and gas fields overlap with Indigenous people's lands. In addition to this, you have legal systems that often enable dispossession. So in the United States, we have mandatory tribal consultation when Indigenous lands are impacted by development or infrastructure projects. While it's mandatory, it's often treated as a checkbox, perfunctory action, far below a free, prior, and informed consent standard internationally. And what we need to understand is that free, prior, and informed consent should be the floor, not the ceiling, in terms of standards. We also have outdated doctrines like the Johnson versus McIntosh doctrine of abolition of Aboriginal title by conquest that is still good law in the United States. There's also the Fifth Amendment takings clause that constitutionally allows Indigenous, has allowed and has facilitated Indigenous lands being labeled as public lands and handed to private industry. So, for example, right now we're seeing in Arizona, Oak Flat, which is a sacred Apache site, has been transferred from public to private foreign mining conglomerate hands for copper extraction. And there's a current fight pending in the Supreme Court of the United States. In terms of law, we're also seeing the weaponization of the law. And we're seeing this as a rise as a tool for dispossession, chilling advocacy, with the passage of critical infrastructure bills, criminalization and crackdown on protests, like you mentioned, and slaps, which you also mentioned. So this report, which is showing 530 instances of slaps brought by private actors, is showing a growing trend. Just recently in the United States, this includes the recent Energy Transfer versus Greenpeace case, which resulted in a $669 million jury verdict for against Greenpeace for standing in allyship with the historic Indigenous-led resistance against Dapple at Standing Rock. And then finally, it's not that Indigenous peoples are anti-development, right? But we're fighting for survival. Development models really violate sacred sites, destroy ecosystems, and threaten existence by default. In addition to development, there's also conservation models that can be a threat, right? Fortress conservation models that create protected areas by displacing Indigenous peoples, criminalizing traditional practices, and erasing Indigenous stewardship. Even though Indigenous peoples are the ones that have managed and protected these ecosystems, are also part of this broad scale that we're seeing. Ultimately, what we need is an evolution of the corporate profit model, right? We can't continue down a line where profits come at the cost of human lives or destruction of sacred places.
Breaking the silence and elevating community voices. Witness Radio, your number one choice.
Thank you so much, Natalie, for sharing your expertise, for highlighting the many legal challenges, but then also calling for different economic models. And this is something that the Resource Center and Indigenous Peoples' Rights International have been exploring with respect to the renewable energy sector and looking at ways in which Indigenous peoples are leading on renewable energy projects and negotiating models of shared prosperity to show there's a different way. And so also I'll ask one of my colleagues to put that report in the chat for anyone who's interested. Thank you so much, Natalie. And now we'll move to hearing from Mary Beth Gallagher. For many of you on the call, some may be familiar with the work of investors, some may be a little bit less familiar. So Mary Beth, what types of actions can investors take when they learn that companies in their investment portfolio are connected with attacks on defenders? And then how has Domini encouraged companies to strengthen their respect for the rights of defenders?
Witness Radio!
Witness Radio!
Witness Radio!
Witness Radio!
Thanks so much, Kristen. Hi, everyone. It's so nice to be here with you. A real honor to join this panel. Thank you, Natalie and Eco, for the work you're doing and for sharing with our community today. Again, I'm Mary Beth, the Director of Engagement at Domini Impact Investments. I'll start by saying that Domini shares the goals of defenders in terms of robust and accelerated climate action for a low carbon transition, preservation of nature, respect for human rights, sustainable and just economies. And for us as an investment firm, we have a responsibility when we're looking at companies in which we invest to consider how they operate, the business models they have, if they're resilient and sustainable for the long term. And we see respect for human rights defenders in their operations, in their relationships with business partners, in the business models they create, as really consistent and grounded in fundamental respect for human rights, including respect for defenders. So this is work that we support. It's work that we try to advance. So I'll talk a little bit about how we do that. We invest in publicly traded companies in debt instruments, and we really consider how those companies operate when we're evaluating whether they're eligible for investment. So first, we're looking for, do they have a policy commitment? Kristen shared that there has been some progress in terms of companies adopting strong human rights policies and really explicitly explaining how their policies consider where their business might contribute to harm or be exposed to risks. But we know we need to do a lot more if only 9 of the companies are meeting that high standard. So one of the things we do is engage directly with companies that we're shareholders in and encourage that robust policy adoption. That policy should be explicit about where their business might cause harm. It should consider how they conduct human rights due diligence, engage directly with rights holders and stakeholders, consider what their impacts might be, develop strategies to prevent harm, to mitigate harm, integrate a gender responsive lens. And we know that starting with that policy that's clear, that's public, that's communicated to a company's partners in business is the first place to start. Unfortunately, even those companies that have strong policies are often linked to harm of defenders. So we want to really understand, how are they developing an infrastructure for policy implementation that's robust? Do you have people who understand human rights principles on your team? Are you establishing processes for stakeholder engagement that are equitable, accessible, properly resourced, where you're building trust with rights holders so they even want to engage with your company? So thinking about the processes, the resourcing that it takes to really make a human rights policy meaningful to us. We also think about the leverage and opportunities we have as shareholders in a company. So I often, most of my work is day-to-day meetings with companies and their executives. It's a really privileged position to be able to speak directly with company executives about how their business is impacting people and how can we think about opportunities to share that space. So for example, a company has an annual shareholder meeting. This year we provided our proxies for 2 farm worker human rights defenders to go directly to that shareholder meeting and speak to the company's board and directors from their own point of view so they can explain why they're supporting certain human rights protections for farm workers in the Northeast US. So thinking about how can we provide that platform and share that information directly. In some of our engagements with the apparel sector, we're also learning directly from human rights defenders who are advocating for worker-driven social responsibility mechanisms or repayment of wages that have been stolen, wage theft cases. So how can we, in our engagement, better understand the context, the risks, the harms, and then lift up that work? We also know that access to remedy and appropriate grievance mechanisms are an important part of the architecture of a meaningful human rights commitment. So we ask companies to be transparent. Are those grievance mechanisms accessible and effective? Are they publishing information about the grievances received, how they're being addressed, how remedy is being provided? That kind of accountability is not only important for investors, but important for rights holders to understand, and human rights defenders in particular, that a company understands its responsibility to make things right. And finally, I'll say that we know that this is primarily the responsibility of states to create a safe operating environment. So we also have advocated for example, the government of Brazil to ratify the Escazú Agreement, which is an important regional agreement for right to information, access to remedy, and participation. And if there's strong legal frameworks and protection, that will create a more stable business environment. It will also help enhance communication directly between defenders and companies, reducing controversies and creating an environment that's really not putting defenders at risk when they're standing up for the rights of nature or for a robust climate action. So those are just a few of the examples of how investors are using our voice and leverage to try to support the goals of respect for human rights defenders. Thank you, Kristen.
Witness Radio, where your voice is a weapon. Justice for all. That's our guarantee. Tune in today. Witness Radio, shining the light.
Thank you so much, Mary Beth, and for outlining your expectations of companies, but then also the different ways in which investors can have leverage through, you know, annual shareholder meetings and giving space to defenders to speak directly at those AGMs, direct engagement with companies, engaging directly with governments. Thank you. So we are going to move into a Q&A portion, and I've already seen a few questions come through in the chat. Please keep adding them. I want to invite my colleague, Lady Nancy Zuluaga-Yaramillo, who is co-author of the report and senior legal researcher and project coordinator, to join us for the Q&A. And we are going to kick off this discussion Q&A with Jeff Sisibagala from the Witness Radio in Uganda to share just a brief reflection. So if we can unmute Jeff. And Jeff, the question I wanted to ask you is, you know, I mentioned before that one of the patterns we see is that a business project will proceed with either no consultation with affected communities or inadequate consultation. And then when people raise concerns, state forces or private security guards attack or arrest protesters. Are you seeing this happen in Uganda and East Africa more broadly? And if so, what does this look like?
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Thank you, Christine. And as introduced, my name is Jeff and I work with Witness Radio. And really, I should congratulate Business Marriage Center for the greater report that actually been republished. But also, to us, this is really timely. First of all, for the situation really in East Africa, as you've described, we are worried that the situation is really getting degenerating further, given that I think governments in East Africa, they are getting, they are adopting militarization of each and every development project. And in particular, I am happy that the report also singles out one of the regional project, which is Tilenga and Kingfisher of ECOP, where we have seen many activists, defenders, students being criminalized, arrested, and many have been really kidnapped. But this is the reason why I think the government is really focusing more on generating profits for these companies, but also maybe for some individuals to benefit from these projects, because concerns that are coming from the public, from defenders, tend really to protect one, their land, two, they're also looking at how the environment is being degraded, which of course all these concerns are not really put into consideration, only that the government, which is using now military and security forces, including private security forces, really to protect the interest of companies. And surprisingly, this is these are governments that are supposed to protect people, and they are really siding with these multinationals, which is really worrying. And even courts and the criminal justice system has been captured, where people who have been arrested for protesting, raising their concerns, they are charged with trumped up charges, sent to prison, and they have again really to be made to pay for bails and police bonds. So this is really a concern, and our fear is that there seem not to be a dad as we speak now. There's no sign that this is going to come to an end, because East Africa is attracting as many land-based investments, and they seem to be using the same script of land acquisition. There's no prior informed consent from the companies. There are no consultations. People do not consent. What happens is really these interests, business interests, public officials are taking advantage of the land, which is supposed to be for community, and then they give it to investors without even considering where these communities are going to stay. There's no alternative resettlement, and even issues to do with by protecting biodiversity, also making sure that actually the environment is protected. I think these are not being put into consideration. And we are seeing more. For instance, this year, as I conclude with News Radio, which of course provides criminal defense to those who have been arrested, defenders and activists. For only for ECOP, we have documented over 40 cases. And so you can imagine, not even the year has not reached into half of it, 6 months before even about 4 months, we have documented over 40. And the number, even yesterday, 2 days ago, students went to protest the involvement of KCB, the Kenya Commercial Bank, which has also come out really to finance this project. But students who are saying that, please, you need to reconsider. So they were rounded up, arrested, now they're in prison. And the government is using state resources really to criminalize and make sure that these voices are gagged. So it's a concern, which I believe that whoever is concerned, I think we need a concerted effort to make sure that these companies tend to listen and then do the right thing. Thank you so much.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Thank you so much, Jeff, for sharing your experience and what you're seeing in Uganda and East Africa more broadly, and highlighting the collusion that often happens between companies, military, government, and also the example you shared just of students that were arrested while just trying to share their concerns with companies and investors. And this is information that companies and investors need to be able to assess risk. It is actually supportive to their ongoing due diligence, and yet people who are raising these concerns are criminalized or otherwise attacked for it. I've seen a number of questions starting to come through in the chat, which is wonderful. Please continue to share any questions you have in the chat. I've seen a few different questions come in about CSDDD. So that is the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive in the European Union. So I'm going to put that question first to any of the speakers that wants to address it. Where is CSDDD now that investors want it watered down? And how can CSDDD be effective when international standards differ greatly between territories? And if anyone also wants to, you know, as you're responding to that question, if there's anything you want to share about CSDDD, as it may be a topic that's newer for some people on the call. So I'll leave it open to anyone who wants to come in.
I can get us started just in terms of how we see that as a useful framing. The Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive is an important framework that talks about company responsibility to evaluate the impacts of their operations for companies based in the European Union or with certain kinds of operations in the EU of a certain size or scale. To understand the impacts of their supply chain and operations and to do stakeholder engagement. What we know is that we need a strong and clear regulatory framework for companies to be encouraged to establish clear policies and ensure they're effectively implemented. And these regulatory drivers are important signals to companies that more needs to be done. But at the heart of it is really a need for a recognition of something Natalie said, business models that are just and sustainable and equitable. Disclosure is just one of the tools in our toolbox to encourage that action. So part of what we try to do is encourage companies to take a human rights-based approach to do human rights impact assessments, to meet regularly with stakeholders, to do that before a project begins in an ongoing way. And to be accountable for the information they receive and have it really shape the way a project moves forward so that input received isn't something that says a project has to stop, but if it moves forward, it has to move forward in a way that's rights respecting. So I think it's helped to center the conversation around human rights responsibilities and disclosure expectations. But I think this report really demonstrates that much more than that is needed.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Witness Radio.
Yeah, thank you, Mary Beth. I'll just add, especially because Europe is not my main area of focus, but I will say that I think there's a need to use international human rights standards and norms and bring them home into local and domestic frameworks. And I think what we're seeing, perhaps in the European Union, but definitely in the United States, is a weakening of regulations, regulatory guardrails that have been, you know, in place for many years, to expect and to force the due diligence, right, in human rights spaces and environmental impacts spaces of development and infrastructure projects. So I think we really need to, not as human rights defenders, as attorneys, as investors in different sectors, whatever sector we're in, recognize that there are international norms, there are international standards, right? Like the ECOSU agreement is a great example in Latin America. But others, right? Other standards internationally that really talk about corporate accountability and how we bring these into the local and regional spaces that we operate in.
Can I just add to that? Hello.
Yes, please, Ethan. Go ahead.
I think it's important for organizations and institutions in the developed countries, like Business and Human Rights Resource Center, to show solidarity and support with organizations in developing countries, and so that CSDDD will be effective, they should capacitate organizations based in developing countries where these projects of multinational companies are doing destructive or extractive industries that are destructive or plunderous to the environment. And I think the organizations based in developed countries has the capacity, the resources to show support and solidarity.
Thank you all for your reflections on that question. And another question that has come in is, how can we increase the visibility of the impact of mining and other extractive business projects on women and girls? And how do we strengthen protection of women and girls as human rights defenders and civic key actors?
I can get us started on this. Just with a concrete example, in the United States and in Canada, I think in North America in particular, and I think more globally now, there's a discussion of the pandemic, right, of the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, as well as Two-Spirit relatives that are impacted by extractive industry. But it is still largely invisible. I think the first time in the United States that there has been a sort of tacit and implicit understanding, corporate recognition that, along with extraction, right, it's a direct correlation, directly correlated to extraction, is violence and human trafficking related to Indigenous women and girls. In Minnesota, Line 3, Enbridge was required to open a public safety fund to not only fund policing and police response that was expected due to expected protests and resistance to deal with that particular pipeline, but also to deal with expected human trafficking from man camps, deriving from man camps. So this is the first time that we saw in the US a company required by a public utility to pay beforehand and create a fund, right? And have that implicit understanding that there is this direct correlation between extraction and an impact on Indigenous women and girls. What I think that, I'm not saying that that's a great model, right? It's not a great model saying, okay, we'll just offset it with money. But it is a start of a push again on a local level. I think right now there is a question, especially within the United States, but also in other countries where we've seen, you know, the rise of authoritarianism, and we've seen strong centralized governments that are also corporate friendly. How do we create change in spaces that are very oppositional, right, or that are not friendly to Indigenous peoples and environmentalists, human rights defenders? And I think there's spaces on the local level and on the regional levels that we really have to explore beyond just the national and international, and it's all related. But that's, I would say, part of creating that visibility and even these reports and these webinars and sharing is that education is really critical to raising the visibility of these issues.
Thank you so much, Natalie. And we will have time for one more question. And Lady, I will direct this one to you because it's about the data in our report. So the data we presented on attacks on human rights defenders, the question is it coming from formal companies, illegal economies, both?
Thank you, Kristen. And I will answer these questions in Spanish, since the question was in Spanish. Bien, nuestra investigación se basa en información que se encuentra disponible públicamente y para esto hacemos una evaluación de si hay una empresa que se encuentra vinculada directamente con el ataque o si la persona defensora está visibilizando una situación en contra de una empresa en particular, así como en contra de sectores en general. Entonces, esto quiere decir que en nuestra investigación bien podemos, más de la mitad de nuestros casos que hemos documentado se vinculan directamente con una empresa, pero muchos otros se vinculan con sectores en un sentido mucho más amplio. Y en este sentido, también hemos monitoreado cuando se encuentran vinculadas economías ilegales, particularmente minería ilegal o extracción ilegal de madera, por ejemplo. Esto es bastante común en América Latina y en el sudeste asiático. Entonces, en nuestra investigación hacemos básicamente un análisis en ambos sentidos. Cuando hay una empresa vinculada a un sector, pero también cuando dentro del marco de estos perpetradores se encuentra algún tipo de economía ilegal. Muchas gracias.
Thank you, Lady. And I want to comment on just one of the comments that came in through the chat about that the map doesn't reflect the repression of human rights defenders in the occupied territories, such as in Western Sahara or in Palestine. And we want to also just welcome anyone on the call. We know there are gaps in the data and that there are many contexts in where due to conflict, due to very high levels of repression, that we don't have access to information about attacks on defenders, challenging corporate harm. So we would very much welcome a conversation with you, collaboration. Also as part of Allied, the coalition I mentioned earlier, supporting land, environmental, and indigenous defenders, we have a data working group where many organizations across the globe who track attacks on human rights defenders share information so that we're able to show a more accurate picture of the scale of the problem, even knowing that what we collectively track is the tip of the iceberg. And so very much welcome being in touch to further those conversations. Any closing reflections from any of the speakers? And then we ask you to stay on for 1 or 2 minutes. We have an action that everyone can take at the end of this call.
I'll just share briefly. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and really recognizing the courageous work of defenders. Know that there are partners and allies in the business community, whether it's investors like Domini or companies that are committed to action. So we'll do our part to try to use the information that's available to advocate for better practices and really to close that implementation gap so that the work of defenders is not as essential and that we are able to operate with more respect for human rights throughout. So thank you for the collaboration and know that there are a lot of investors and partners really eager to support this courageous work.
Iko, over to you.
Can I just add to that? I think it is also pointed by Natalie that, and I also narrated that from different governments, different regimes or administration in the Philippines, we face environmental destructive projects, environmental plunder, and human rights violations. And I think it's good to point out that these are because it's always the same development and economic framework or economic models that we have. It's always the neoliberal framework that harms not only the people, the indigenous people, but also the environment. So it is important that we shift from this development and economic model and find a model that is suitable for the people that will develop the people and that is sustainable for the environment. Thank you.
I'll just close by reflecting. There's a song by Silvio Rodriguez, who's a singer, songwriter, poet, that says, "He preferido hablar de cosas imposibles porque de lo posible se sabe demasiado." And in English, that would be, "I prefer to talk about impossible things because too much is known about what is possible." So I think what we need to finally see is that destruction, desecration, dispossession, criminalization, lawfare cannot be the model. Oak Flat cannot be the model. Jukon Gorge, right? The destruction of a 46,000-year-old cultural site that was destroyed by an Australian mining company cannot be the model. Standing Rock, Line 3, 800, 900 arrests cannot be the model. So we need a new model that protects both people and planet, puts life above all. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for sharing your experiences, your insights, and for that call at the end for new models, because those exist and they're being created by so many people, defenders on this call, defenders that we're all in connection with. And so our gratitude to you all and to everyone who's joined this conversation. We want to close with an action in support of a defender. One of the human rights defenders included in this report, a Cambodian indigenous environmental journalist, Ok Mau, was arrested last Friday from his home. He has been documenting and reporting on alleged illegal deforestation in northeast Cambodia, including by a mining company. And this is not the first attack he's faced because of his courageous work. In March, he was physically attacked. He has received a number of threats, and he is facing 15 legal complaints, raising really serious concerns about the use of the judicial system in Cambodia to silence both his environmental reporting, but also the reporting of environmental journalists across the country. And so Cambodia, one of our partners in Cambodia, has put out a joint statement calling for his immediate release. I'm going to put that statement, a link to a Google Doc in the chat, where we welcome your signatures, either if your organizations are willing to endorse this statement in support of the release of Ok Mau, or if you want to sign as an individual, just keeping in mind security concerns, we'd really welcome you to take that action in this last minute or right after we end this call. Thank you again for being here. I know I've expressed gratitude many times, but that is really how I'm feeling for all of you. And we've put in the chat links to the report, again, available in English, Spanish, Portuguese, and French, with key findings in Japanese and Russian. And we really welcome collaboration with anyone on this call and those in your networks. So please do feel free to be in touch. Big thanks again to our speakers and wishing you all a great evening and rest of the day or morning.
Thank you for listening to Witness Radio broadcast program.